coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Have you ever had to make a decision?
I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider.
You make decisions all the time. Do you do so rationally, or are you predictably irrational?
Here's how I make decisions. I chill out, let the inner me decide, and do what it says.
Here's how I make decisions. I add things up, think them through calmly, and act.
How do you make decisions?
I say I listen to all voices, but mine's the final decision.
Who makes your decisions? You or the irrational demons within?
Wow, he's always wrong.
But he sure is decisive.
Our guest is Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational.
Making Decisions, coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the irrationality of human decision-making.
Speak for yourself. Can I make decisions in a perfectly rational way? First, I decide what I want and how much I really want each of those things. Then I survey my options for getting them. I assess the upside benefits and the downside costs of each alternative. Finally, I choose the alternative that really has the greatest upside and the least downside. It's pretty simple to be rational.
John, it may be simple for you because of you, I guess, are a paragon of rationality when it comes to making decisions. But you know, most people aren't paragons of rationality like you. In fact, most people are pretty irrational in their decision making.
Well, how very odd. How do these lesser human beings go wrong, and why?
Well, John, I'm not quite sure why, but they go wrong at nearly every turn that you just mentioned. They're not so good at figuring out what they want, first of all, or how much they want it. Their preferences aren't very stable. They're not very coherent often. And this thing about assessing risk and reward, they're really bad at that. You name it, when it comes to decision-makings, we humans, we're bad at it.
Surely you're exaggerating, Ken. Give me some evidence to back up these wild claims.
Well, let's play a little game. Let's call it sellers and choosers, okay? There are two lovely mugs here in the studio. They're exactly alike. One of them I'm just going to give to you, and one maybe is for me. The mug I'm going to give you, it's yours to keep. You can do what you like with it. You can even sell it if you'd like. You're the seller.
Okay, so I've got this nice mug. It's very nice. Got a picture of our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, on it. I really like it. I bet I'd be willing to sell it for the right price.
Okay, you'd be willing to sell it. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to write down the lowest price at which you'd be willing to sell your lovely mug there.
Okay, done. Now, what about your mug? Do you get to keep yours, too?
Well, it's not really mine yet. I have to make a choice. I get to choose between the mug and a sum of money. I'm the chooser.
How much money?
Well, there's a price written on the bottom of the mug. Think of that as the market price. I don't get to see the market price. What I have to do is I have to write down an amount of money that if I had a choice between that amount of money and the mug, I'd be utterly indifferent. Call that the fair price. I have to write down what I think is a fair price, right? I get the mug. I get to keep the mug only if the price I write down is higher than the price written on the bottom of the mug, only if my fair price is higher than the market price.
Okay, we got identical mugs. Each of our mugs has a price written on the bottom. I'm the seller. I've written down the price at which I'd sell my mug. Now, you're going to write down the price at which you would buy the mug that isn't really yours yet. So
right.
What's the big deal? What's that going to show?
Well, if you run this little experiment thousands of times and put people in different roles, sometimes the role of the seller and sometimes the role of the chooser, guess what you find?
I'm waiting with bated breath.
Well, you find that the sellers place a significantly higher price, like at least twice the price on the mug than the choosers do.
You mean if the mug is already mine, I think it's worth a lot more than a similar mug that isn't mine. My price is probably higher than the price you wrote down.
Exactly. That's called, there's a couple different things going on here. There's what they call loss aversion and what they call an endowment effect. People tend to value the things they already have and might lose much more highly than the things they don't have but could get.
I think I've just had an insight into my own life. My garage is full of stuff, that I wouldn't buy at a garage sale.
Right.
I guess my wife must be irrational.
Yeah, well, if she tried to sell it at a garage sale, she'd price it at a price that nobody would pay, right?
So it looks like those calculations I was talking about, upside benefits and downside costs, are highly skewed when an ordinary person makes them. It doesn't make any sense.
Right, right, because they're kind of they're asymmetric about gains and losses. John, you're catching on. And that's just one tiny little example. There are literally hundreds of experiments that demonstrate that people are massively irrational in the way that we make decisions.
Luckily for us, we've got one of the world's leading investigators of human irrationality standing by. Dan Ariely, author of the best-selling Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions.
And we urge our listeners to choose to call in. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, gets deeper into this idea of loss aversion. She files this report.
Ram Brafman and his brother Ori started with a simple idea.
Making a rational decision would mean making a decision that's in one's best interest.
And then they asked why we so often make decisions that, well, aren't. The result was the book Sway, The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior. The Brafmans discovered humans are not the calculating, rational entities economists have long supposed us to be. Instead, we often make decisions based on emotion and flawed perceptions.
The pain associated with a loss is a lot more intense than the equivalent gain that associated with winning something. So when we lose, we feel it 2.5 times more intensely than when we win something. So for example, you know, if we went and, you know, there was a certain card game that you went to Vegas and you played and you lost $20.
Brafman says you'd be more upset about losing the $20 than you would be pleased about winning the same amount.
And part of it is because when we lose money, we start feeling inadequate. We start second-guessing ourselves. We start feeling stupid. Why did I lose that? And what can I do to make up for it? But the irony is that in making up for it, we start taking a lot more risks and putting ourselves at danger and acting even more irrationally and more irrationally. And the bigger the loss, the more irrational decisions we make.
So losing that $20 could be the start of a very long night at the card table. Brafman says the current economic crisis is also a result of irrational behavior, specifically the kind that happens in groups. He says people are predisposed to go along with what other people say.
Now, it's really important in a group to have people who are comfortable speaking up and dissenting. But what happens when you have large companies, it's really difficult for individual employees to rise up and say, I think we're making a bad decision over here.
He says that's exactly what was going on in the banks who bought up so-called toxic assets.
They took on risks that were way too risky. And the reason is that there weren't enough dissenters who stood up and said, wait a minute, this is something that we shouldn't be doing. And it's not that the bankers didn't know what they were getting themselves into. If they would have looked at the data, they would have said, look, we're taking too much risk here. But it's really difficult when you're surrounded by people who are like, yeah, 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 and you have too many cheerleaders on the team. It's really difficult to be the person who can be dissenting.
He says naysayers aren't necessarily smarter than everybody else, but they do provide something critical to making good decisions, an outside perspective.
We talked to Justice Stephen Breyer from the Supreme Court, and he said that the process of dissent is so important on the court because what happens is when the justices are able to hear each other out and disagree with one another, in a way it's a pain in the neck because they have to take all the different perspectives and points of views and integrate them into the opinion, but the opinion comes out a lot better as a result.
The book Sway argues making good decisions often means fighting our deep-seated desire to be certain about things, to trust our intuitions and first impressions. That's basically the opposite of the findings in Malcolm Gladwell's popular book Blink, which claims humans are surprisingly good at making decisions fast and with very little information. Ron Brafman says quick decision-making can be useful in some cases.
But when it comes to really complicated decisions, when it comes to really life-changing decisions, we don't want to do that. I don't want to propose to somebody and ask them to marry me because I had a blink moment that I really loved them. I don't want to sell all my 401k stock portfolio because I had a blink moment that the market is going to go down.
So while you never get a second chance to make a first impression, you might want to start taking your second impressions more seriously. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Dan Ariely. He's professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He's author of the best-selling Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Dan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Dan, you're an economist. And at the center of economics is Homo economicus, or somebody like that, this paragon of rational decision-making. So how did a nice, young, self-respecting economist like you end up on a show like this, where we're looking at irrational human behavior?
Well, I don't know how I got here, but
briefly,
I can tell you that the image that you portrayed in the beginning, John, I don't think we would have needed to go that far to see that you're irrational. We could probably have just talked to your wife for 5 minutes, or your kids.
For my wife, maybe a minute would do, I think.
I actually started becoming in economics by becoming interested in irrationality. So for me, irrationality started first. I was in hospital for many years as a burn patient. And what really was very difficult for me was the process in which the nurses removed my bandages. So let me ask you, if you had a patient with 70% burn, how would you take their bandages off? Would you remove them quickly, rip them off one after the other, or would you take them off slowly? What would you do?
What an excruciating choice.
Well, yeah,
I don't know. If I were the patient, I'd be horrified at the thought of them ripping off. I imagine if they ripped them off quickly, I'd be in great pain. If they rip them off slowly, I'd be in pain longer. So I don't know.
Well, I've never been that burned, but I know that when you used to have the old style adhesive tape, it was better to rip it off than to remove it slowly, although it was hard to make yourself do it.
Is there a right answer here, Dan?
So there is a right answer, but it turns out that the nurses in my department thought that the right answer was the quick removal.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I would argue with them in the process, and I hated this tearing of the bandages, as you can imagine, it's incredibly painful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to remove a Band-Aid when you have skin underneath it. It's another thing to remove a bandage when you have no skin and really adheres to the flesh. And they thought they were right. They told me explicitly they were right. And they also reminded me that the word patient doesn't mean to intervene or make suggestions or interfere.
I see.
But this question bothered me for years. And when I got into the university, I started doing experiments on this. Initially, I didn't have enough money, so I went to a hardware store and I bought a carpenter's vise. And I would bring people into the lab and I would crunch their fingers a little bit. And I would crunch their fingers for a long time and short time and high intensity and low intensity and increasing pain and decreasing pain. And then I would ask them, so how painful was this and how painful was that? And which one of the last two would you rather do again if you had to? And what I learned from all of this was that the nurses were wrong. That here were good people with good intentions, making very important decisions and having ample opportunity to learn. And nevertheless, they were wrong every time.
Oh, right. And I take it the point about their irrationality, because I read in the preface to your book this story, you went back and you tried to convince them that they were wrong, right? And they weren't moved by this welter of evidence that you gathered.
Well, it's kind of a mixed story, and it's interesting. They did decide to change their practices, but they told me something else interesting, but they said that I didn't take their pain into account.
Oh.
They said that for them to do what was I thought was good for me was going to take them 2 hours instead of 1 hour, and they didn't think it would work out. And it's actually an interesting thing. If you think about it, every time you test your intuitions, you check whether you're rational or not, you're taking a risk. The nurses would have taken a risk by doubling the duration of the treatment, making life harder for them, for an unclear reward, and therefore they were not willing to try it out.
So did these nurses all go on to become investment bankers by any chance?
No. It turns out there's a lot of irrationalities out there. You know, this is just one little one, very painful, but one little one. And from then on, I've been trying to look at all kinds of behaviors in all kinds of ways, in shopping, investing, whatever, in which people have all the right ingredients to make good decisions, good intentions, plenty of experience. But nevertheless, we don't get things right.
Well, we're going to take this up and dig into it in some detail after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing decision-making and why we're often so bad at it. Our guest is Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational.
We've been trying to get a grip on why human beings are so irrational. In our next segment, we'll define rationality and irrationality and gather more evidence about human irrationality. Why are humans pervasively and massively irrational, or are they? Join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
How irrational are we? Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Did you ever have to make up your mind? Was a choice you made based on reason? You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing human reason and the irrationality of human decision-making. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Do you consider yourself a rational decision-maker? Have you ever had an outburst of irrationality, ever been subject to aversion loss or loss aversion or the endowment effect? What kinds of things influence your decisions?
Tell us your stories. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Dan Ariely from Duke University, author of Predictably Irrational.
Dan, before we get in, start plunging into some of your wonderful experimental results that demonstrate the pervasiveness of human irrationality, I'd like you to start out by defining what you think of as rational and what you think of as irrational, just to be clear from the start.
So there are many definitions, of course, of irrationality. The first one in economics basically says that preferences are complete and transitive. So transitive means that if you prefer A to B and B to C, you would also prefer A to C. And complete means that for everything in the world, you could order their preferences. That's a technical definition. It's what economics is based on. And it's not very interesting.
Is it even close to being true of people?
Yeah, well,
no.
Well, I want to hear the more interesting. I want to focus on the interesting.
I think there are two interesting definitions. The first one is to think about the things that are not a part of the economic rational perspective, but nevertheless we exhibit every day. So, for example, being not selfish. In economic theory, you should be selfish. You should never, for example, go to vote. Voting is a big mystery for economists because your vote is very unlikely to be the decisive vote in the election, and for sure it will take you some time. So if you just do the cost-benefit analysis, you should not vote.
Or yeah, but
why would you ever leave a tip to a waitress in a town that you're not going to go to back? Again, but so those things are not a part of the economic theory, but they're part of everyday life. But for me, the most interesting definition is the definition that says that being irrational means that we behave not according to how we ourselves understand how we would behave. And the reason I care about this definition is because this is the place where we could get into trouble. So imagine, for example, tell me if you had this experience, that you go to lunch vowing to watch your diet, and then the waiter comes up with chocolate souffle. And you change your decision.
Right.
No, I've never had that experience. I don't know why I'm so heavy.
Yeah. Right. Oh. Go ahead.
So those are cases where at the moment that you make the decision, you don't understand yourself very well and you make different predictions. Now, dieting is one thing. You can think about unsafe sex. There's a lot of things like that.
Let me interrupt you just for just a second. So let's put a gloss on what you said. So there's a lot of things that we do sort of maybe in the moment that in moments of calmer reflection, we would say, shoot, why did I do that? And the more of those that pile up, the more of like, shoot, why did I do that? Why did I, you know, the more of those that pile up on us, the more irrational we are. Is that a gloss on how you would think about this?
That's right. And it doesn't have to be in the moment, and we don't have to recognize it later. So there could be things in your behavior that I could point out to you. And the moment I point them out to you, you say, my goodness, why did I do that? And those are the problems, because this is the place where we're going to get ourselves into trouble.
So Dan, you've done lots of fascinating experiments. Can you pick out the most, if you just have one that really shows what you're getting at, what would it be?
So here's an experiment that looks at how people decide how much they're willing to pay for things. I go into a big class of students and I show them a set of products, some chocolate, some computer accessories, some wines. I circulate them and then I ask people to tell me the last two digits of their social security number. So John, what's yours?
Oh, we have 9-2.
9-2. And Ken?
9-1. Well, let's say 1-9. Okay, 1-9.
Thank you. So John said 9-2. Ken said 1-9. And then I would say, let's translate into dollars and tell me whether hypothetically you would be willing to pay. John, would you pay $92 for each of those things? And Ken, would you pay $19 for each of those? And you would say yes or no, depending on your preferences.
Yeah.
Then I would say, let's have an auction. This will be for real. The winner will pay the price and get it and so on. Please submit a bid. People submit a bid. We find out who's the winner. They pay. They go home. And then I calculate the relationship between people's last two digits of the Social Security number and how much they paid. Now, it's a preposterous idea to think that those two things would be related. But they relate in a big way. In fact, people with higher ending Social Security number can end up paying hundreds of percents more than people with low ending Social Security numbers.
Now, this isn't just their Social Security number. It's because you made them think about their Social Security number. So they got this number in their mind, right?
That's right. It's all about the influence of how we think about something changes how we think about it for longer than we understand.
Right, right.
Well, in fact, the first decisions have huge impact on our lives, and we don't understand that.
Right. When I was in college, I was a salesman for a while in the summers, and they used to say, sell down. That is, when a customer walks in, always show them the highest priced item, right, that they might possibly want to buy. And you're not going to sell them the highest price item, but you'll sell them the thing right below the highest price item. And it apparently works like charm.
It does. And the interesting thing is how you fight it. So we just bought a house not too long ago, and believe me, the real estate agent had the same lesson that you had. She wanted to show us a house that was way out of our reach. Thankfully, I knew this effect, so I didn't let her do that.
But there must be some limits to this. Like, I saw an ad the other day for a $30,000 car, and they were trying to sell that to people on the basis of 3 years free oil changes. Now, would anybody be irrational enough to have their decision affected by that?
I can't possibly imagine where you read this. Of course, it's my own story, but how I became interested in free. That's right. You know, it's interesting. We fall into these traps all the time, and it takes a while to kind of step back and realize that. And for me, this fact that I bought the wrong car because they had free oil change for 3 years really started the whole research stream on what is the value of free. And so, it turns out we overreact to free in a dramatic way and sometimes with devastating consequences.
Not to mention free oil.
But this is free air. We're talking about human irrationality, the irrationality of human decision-making with our guest Dan Ariely. And we'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And Stephanie in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie.
Hi. You're absolutely right. People are insanely irrational. And I wanted to tell a little anecdotal story, which kind of illustrates my point. I had a friend who just kind of like completely was arguing with me for 15 minutes about where Silicon Valley was and that it was located next to L.A., never mind the fact that the phone call was coming from Cisco in Silicon Valley. And, he just goes for 10 minutes like that. And I just wonder, there's something about people not wanting to admit that they're wrong. Some people just cannot, on any circumstances, admit that they've made an error. And I don't know if you guys have noticed that too, but there's some people it's like a sign of weakness or a flaw or something, you know. Just kind of ludicrous.
Well, there is a difference between Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley.
But that's redneck.
Thanks for the call, Stephanie. Dan, I want to press that point in a little bit. There's not just our decision making, but you know what we're willing to believe and what evidence that we're willing to use to update our belief. There's something called confirmation bias, where you only seek out confirmatory evidence. Have you done any work in that kind of?
Yes, so I've done, and there's a lot of literature on this, but going back to Stephanie's point, you can even think about the example you started the show with, the endowment effect. It turns out the endowment effect is not just about mugs and our children, that the moment something is ours, we think of it as more valuable. It even works for ideas and opinions.
Right.
And the moment you design an opinion and you think it's yours, we just fall in love with it. And falling in love with it makes us love it more, and then we just don't look at disconfirming evidence. So think to yourself, forget about your political affiliation. Have you listened to much radio shows that portray the opposite side of your view on the political spectrum? Probably not that much.
Well, I because we feel, but you know, that's, I'm a weird creature.
Okay. Most people don't. We We like to get opinions and information that suits our position, that doesn't put us in uncomfortable, difficult situation. So we do what we call confirmation bias. We just look for evidence that what we think already is the right thing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the irrationality of human decision-making with Dan Ariely. You can join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. Are you a paragon of rationality like John Perry, or are you one of these schmucks like me who fall into local outburst of irrationality all the time? Jillian in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jillian.
Well, hey, you guys. So I watched this amazing documentary by BBC called The Century of the Self, which goes into the idea that the world of irrational that we live in was actually exploited by Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays. And I was wondering, what is the professor's thoughts on that, and whether any of that is included in his book, kind of the history of the people who researched and exploited our irrational human minds?
Right, Dan, that's a good question. I mean, your book is...
Since examining that, I do my best to overcome my irrational minds. And I am a woman, though, and so there's a certain
Let me dispel this belief. We don't find any evidence of big gender differences between men and women on irrationality. At least not the kind of thing that we've tested.
But Dan, I like Jillian's question, because on the one hand, your book is addressed to the ordinary Joes like us, right? It helps us guard against this. But for a lot of marketers, these are trade secrets, and they're probably upset at you for revealing their trade secrets. I mean, how much are we exploited by people who knew this already?
So you know, I think sometimes we are exploited. You would be surprised how little companies actually know what's going on in general sense. But sometimes we are exploited, and sometimes this goes very badly. So I gave you the chocolate cake example. So waiters know about it. It turns out, for example, that some bankers thought about the equivalent mortgage to chocolate souffle. So here's how it looks like. It's called a 228 mortgage, and it was offered only in the subprime mortgage category. And it basically gave people 2 years of very cheap interest followed by 28 years of very expensive interest. In fact, I met somebody recently who had reached the 28-year portion of his mortgage, and he was paying a little bit over 12% in that category. Now, that was basically preying on people's weaknesses, on the chocolate souffle kind of problem, that you dangle something immediate in front of people in terms of a benefit. They forgo the long-term thought. They just focus on the immediate and make huge mistakes. Now, in this particular case, these bankers made short-term gains and cost all of us a lot of aggravation in the long term. But they clearly understood something about people's over-interest in short-term benefits.
We've got more callers on the line. Holly in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Holly.
Hello. I guess this is a different version of the same thing, the short-term interest and long-term. I'm a dietitian, and so I'm interested in people's eating habits and the whole phenomenon of if you buy one apple pie at McDonald's, you get the second one free, or if you buy one bucket of popcorn at the theater, you get a second one for half price. And I always say no, and they look at me like I'm crazy, and you know, so many people who are already having health problems just cannot turn down that free apple pie or popcorn.
Good
so,
point.
So first of all, you are crazy.
Crazy to buy the first one.
Well, that's one version, but the second one is get the second one and give it to somebody else. Here is the issue. It turns out that this trade-off between short-term benefits and long-term goals is an inherent problem of the human behavior, and it's why we don't exercise and don't save, and why we overeat and procrastinate and all of those things. And here's a way to think about it. Imagine I gave you a choice. Do you want half a box of Godiva chocolate right now, or do you want a full box of Godiva chocolate in a week? Well, most people would say, give me the half a box of chocolate right now, implying that it's not worthwhile to wait a week for another half a box of chocolate. What if I pushed this decision to the future? What if I said, would you rather have half a box of chocolate in a year or a full box of chocolate in a year in a week? Now people would say, of course I'll wait. It's definitely worth it. What is happening is that delaying something in the immediate future is so painful for us that we need to be compensated drastically for doing so. But in the future, we're all about good intentions.
Well, so Dan, you really have a macabre a mind, and I'm glad you do to design all these experiments. Let me ask you a more general, practical question, though. Should we try to become more rational, or should we just learn how we work and manipulate ourselves? For example, put a picture of an obese person on the refrigerator door. Which is going to be more effective for me, say, keeping my calories down, becoming a stronger willed human being, or just manipulating myself with all sorts of little tricks?
Yeah, so I think it's very hard to find our innate nature. You know, we have evolutionary to thank for creating us the way we are. These are very powerful effects, and it's very hard to change ourselves. I mean, you can imagine that maybe if you were a Zen master, you might be able to sub-stress some of your needs. But for most of us, it will be incredibly hard. So what we need to do is we need to think about how we design the world such that it fits better with what we want to be. And this element of designing the world is actually very important. You can think about how, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense to make us like sugar and fat, and it made a lot of sense to make it such that even when we finish eating, our brain doesn't feel we had enough until 20 minutes later, because food was not that available, and by the time we found something, it was good to store it and so on. Now that we design the world and we can create food that is just sugar and fat, it makes less sense all of a sudden, and we can get ourselves into trouble. So you need to think about maybe not going to the supermarket yourself and doing all your purchases online, because this way you will not be tempted by the smell of the cakes and the baked goods. How do you create small portions? Maybe instead of cooking a huge portion and saying, I will just eat part of it, you decide to cook less, and therefore the cost of increasing food...
It sounds like you're a big fan of kind of like, I don't know what to call it, social engineering, or maybe it's self-engineering. We have to engineer our circumstances in a way that protects ourselves from our kind of innate proclivities that made sense in one situation, but don't make sense in a current situation. That's kind of like your structured procrastination. Yeah.
I think so. That's exactly it, and that's how I started in this profession, is to think about, you know, we have to deliver some treatment to burn patients. We have to take the bandages off. What is the best way to do it? We have to eat. How do we do it? And the interesting thing is, when we design the physical world, we in many ways understand our limitations. When we design things like chairs and tables and shoes, we build them for people, not to Superman. But when we design things for the mental world, we all of a sudden think that we're perfectly capable. When we design things like the stock market, healthcare, retirement plans, all of a sudden we don't recognize these limitations.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing decision-making with Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational.
We've been exploring the extent of human irrationality. We've been looking at philosophical arguments, but also experimental evidence. In our next segment, we'll explore some of the social and economic consequences of this irrationality. Does it have the potential to lead us into economic and social disaster? I mean, didn't it just do so? And what can we do to protect ourselves against such outcomes?
Living with the consequences of human irrationality, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do we really have freedom of choice, or are we doomed to make irrational decisions? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Dan Ariely, a professor of economics from Duke University, author of the best-selling book, Predictably Irrational.
Dan, let's move right to the big issues. Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, recently told Congress that his whole worldview was shaken by the recent economic turmoil. He seemed to be saying that the movers and shakers on Wall Street have turned out to be far less rational about the management of risk than he had imagined. Was he right about that? Was he stupid to believe that in the first place?
Well, you know, I don't think he was stupid, but I think that his speech would basically, I would summarize as, oops. is a part of the difficulty of actually proving irrationality. You know, so for many years, I would do all these experiments that I describe, and people would say, oh, yes, these are very, very nice and very convincing. But surely when it will come to big things and professional people and the market and competition, all of these things will go away. Well, turns out they don't go away. You could argue rationally or logically, why would they go away? But it turns out they don't. And this is the only solace I find in this terrible situation, that at least professionally it's helping behavioral economists get some foot up now.
Let me press you at this point about it not going away. Maybe an individual human mind is not fit to make it go away just by choice, just by discipline. But you might think that surely the discipline of the market will force irrational decision makers out. Right. Well,
why?
Force them out of business? I don't know, because they're miscalculating risk and rewards. If they take inordinate risk, right? They take inordinate downside risk, right? Or if they fail to get the upside reward, then somebody else is going to get it, and they're going to, you know.
So it turns out that learning is actually very difficult, much more difficult than you imagine. If we had catastrophe like we had this year happening every week, I think people would learn much faster. But the fact is, we don't have those things all the time, and I think about the following. I'm an experimentalist, right? What I do is I take a phenomena and I try to push it up or down, procrastination or something. And if you think about what we've done with the stock market recently, we've done all kinds of experiments to see how it works. We put $700 billion in. Oh, did it go up? Not really. We put $160 billion in other packages. Nothing happened. All of those things basically make us realize how little we understand the stock market. And I think it's actually very, very hard to understand.
Let me ask you a question, though. Do we misunderstand the stock market because we misunderstand the psychology of the individual actor that gets aggregated up into the behavior of the market?
That's one of the elements. There are many elements here. I'll give you just two examples, actually. The first one is you're at Stanford. You play some sports at Stanford? Something like, is the sports team?
Oh, yeah.
We have many sports
teams. We beat Duke whenever we play them in anything.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say you play basketball. If you play a game and let's say you're Stanford fans and you play against Duke, is there a way for you to see the referee making a close call in a way that is against your team in the right way? Probably not. You will be biased in looking at the world because you have this Stanford perspective when you look at things. Now, what about if the television was very small and the screen was very blurry? It was very hard to make decisions. It was very hard to figure out the details. Then you could even interpret more actions of the referee as being against your team when they shouldn't be, and being upset with them.
The less information, the more decisions you make.
It's the more fuzzy the medium by which you make decisions, the more latitude you can take in interpreting them in any way that you want. We are fantastic rationalizer machines.
Yeah.
And what we do is we take information and rationalize it. Now imagine you got paid millions of dollars to see the world in a certain view. Could you really not be biased to see it in the view that really works for you?
I get your point. I still want to try and rescue poor old human mind a little bit.
Go
more
for
here.
It.
So you in your book, you talk about the difference between social norms and norms of the marketplace, economic norms. And, you know, there's this game that some behavioral economists and others have experimented with people. It's called the ultimatum game. I give John $100 and I say to him, "Okay, you got to divide this money with Dan. And here's the rule. You can make him whatever offer you want. If Dan accepts the offer, then you both get the money. If he doesn't accept the offer, then neither of you get the money. Since it's money from heaven for you, you should accept whatever offer he gives you. But people won't accept what they regard as an unfair offer. They'll say, wait a minute, you know, I want half or 40%. I won't take $10.
And you're defending the human mind?
No, because yes. Because the reason people refuse these deals is because they're trying to enforce a norm of fairness. Social rationality is about fair dealing. Right.
The thing is, so it's, again, it's a question of how do we define irrationality. But what you're doing is, it turns out that people play this game even when they know they will never meet this guy again, when it's anonymous and there's no way for any benefit for learning.
Right.
So what you're saying is you're willing to suffer just to make somebody do something else, maybe differently in the future. It's a very strange idea. But let me tell you how this game actually plays into this understanding the stock market.
Okay.
There's a slightly different version of this game called the trust game with revenge. So John, I give you $10, and Ken, you get $10. John, you're the first actor. You can decide to pass your $10 to Ken or to keep them. If you keep your money, you both go home with $10. If you pass it to Ken, the money quadruples. Now Ken has 50, his original 10 plus 40, and he can decide if to go home with 50 or to give you back 25. The first thing is that people in the economic theory should never give the money. John should never give the money to Ken, and Ken should never give back, and everybody should just go home with $10. But people are too trusting and too reciprocating.
Yeah,
there's a good chance that...
I would definitely give him the 10 and count on his goodwill.
That's right. Now, but there's a kink to this, which is what will happen if Ken will go away with the $50, go home? And now I give John an opportunity. John, I give you an opportunity to take revenge. I said, John, listen, Ken went away with your $50. If you pay me, Dan, money, for every dollar you pay me, I will take $2 away from Ken. Now you have a chance to lose even more money than you've just lost.
Yeah, right.
But you can make Ken suffer. Would you do that?
And what's the answer? What do people? How do people play that game?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people. Spend more money to exhibit revenge. And what's even more interesting is when you look at their brain with a PET scan, you can see that the same part of the brain that is activated when people plan and execute revenge is the same part of the brain that reacts to pleasure, to things like food and sex and heroin.
But Dan, see I get your, I take your point. And from an economic perspective, I see the irrationality. I see you can get taken to the cleaners. But I grant that. But I still want to say there's a light side to this. There's a dark side to it, which you've pointed out. Right, and we run the risk of economic ruin. But there's also a light side, because this kind of stuff is deeply involved in what you call social norms. It's the stuff that binds us together in communities that govern themselves by rules of fairness. Now, if it's true that if we always had the option to exit and never encounter these people again, then, you know, it would be like, what a putz you are. But since we don't always have the opportunity, at least not in the evolved situation, we don't always have these opportunities for exit, right? So do you see what I'm trying to say?
I'm absolutely seeing, and you can actually think about how this will work out. So John, imagine you and I lived 1,000 years ago, and you were considering stealing my donkey. If you knew that I was an economic rational thinker, you would say, well, it will take Dan 4 days to make enough money to buy a new donkey. As long as I run far enough, he will never chase me, and you will just take my donkey. But what if you knew that I was a revengeful type? What if you realized that I will chase you to the end of the world, I would get my donkey back, and I'll take all your goats as well? All of a sudden, you will be less likely to take my donkey to start with.
Well, I'm
so in some interesting sense, you can think about revenge as actually creating some social harmony and cooperation. All of that is perfectly true. It's just not a part of rational theory. It's not a part of the economic theory that defines both law and how we build things like the stock market.
Well, you know,
and it's not something that people understand.
I think this show's economists shouldn't have just read Adam Smith. They should have gone back and read his teacher Hume, because Hume has this problem. You know, why would a farmer help another farmer bring in his crops? Because he can never be certain that farmer will turn around the following year and help him bring in his crops. And he kind of says, well, it's not a rational thing, but it's a fortunate thing. I'd like to just get your quick comment on the connection between your ideas and another author we had on the show, Nassim Taleb, and his book, The Black Swan. What are our irrational dispositions towards these very unusual perfect storm type situations?
So Nassim Taleb makes the central point is that we people don't think about negative circumstances. And this goes by all kinds of names. One of the names we call it is the planning fallacy. So we all have experience with students. Imagine the following study. Imagine we ask students, under the best circumstances, how long will it take you to do your honor thesis? And they say 3 months. And then we say, under the worst circumstances, how long will it take you to do your honor thesis? 6 months, okay? Now, how much time will it really take you? They say 3 months. They basically don't take bad things into account. When we plan how long will it take us to get home or how will our work day plan, we don't take negative things into account to the extent that they will happen. And one of Nassim's point is that we focus on the center of the distribution and we don't think of the outliers, even though the outliers are so crucial to what can happen to us and the consequences.
But to make a Ken-like point, if people didn't think that way, they'd never have children. So there are there are good consequences to this.
You know, we can actually have a whole show about whether people really think about having children. I tell you, people believe that they have really the thought about it, but, you know, nature has a big part to play with this.
So in your world, nobody votes and nobody has children.
It's pretty gloomy. And nobody enforces norms of fairness. Yeah, either. Dad, I'm going to...
World is much kinder, by the way. I'm hoping to build a better world. I think if we take irrationality, we'll build something much better.
Okay, Dan, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest has been Dan Ariely. He's professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He's author of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. So, John, you paragon of rationality, what did you learn today?
Well, I'll just disclose to our listeners that I'm really not a paragon of irrationality. I'm actually a defender of procrastination as a great human resource. Well, I learned that, there's more to economics than the Chicago School and Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan. There's intelligent, sensitive, humorous people out there. So that's good news.
Yeah, that's good news. That's really great news. You know, we didn't get into how Dan Ariely really helps to reshape the field of economics, because this discipline of his, behavioral economics, is really only like 20, 25 years old. And it was actually started by a bunch of psychologists, Kahneman and Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, who were studying all these weird things that people do in decision making. And then the economists have sort of taken note. They actually won a Nobel Prize. Two psychologists, well, Kahneman did, won a Nobel Prize in economics because Tversky was dead because of their work in psychology. That's really cool.
Yes, Amos Tversky was a really fine person as well as a great psychologist. His premature death was a great loss to Stanford. So Stanford can take a little credit for getting this new movement in economics started.
Oh, well, a lot of credit, actually. But you know what? This conversation continues on our Facebook page, and you can, if you're on Facebook, you can join our community. It's an ever-growing community. We'd love to have you be a member.
You know, for the final word, we're going to turn to the always decisive, always rational, always fast-talking, always humorous, Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, economics, the dismal science, was actually, until the recent financial unpleasantness, pretty sassy. It was all infomercials and large print bestsellers reassuring us with a toothy grin that whatever our decisions were, buying short, long, or just hugging our cards to our chest, we were guaranteed a profit. Our self-confident and never-wise free marketplace expanded beyond mere goods and services into a wondrous new arena, where we did not have to actually buy anything, but instead could decide to place complicated wagers on whether a particular good or service would go up or down in value. This led to a number of strange financial instruments: collateralized mortgage obligations, layered options, structured investment vehicles, derivatives, tranches. Instrumental in the creation of these was a new field, behavioral finance, which attempted to make any perceived rationality in the marketplace subject to computer models, chaos theory, and complicated algorithms. The highly paid big brains that came up with this stuff are known as quantitative analysts, or quants. I recently came across a 1994 feature in Wired magazine by Kevin Kelly about a quant, one Doan Farmer, called by Wired a guru, high-tech legend, and a principal character in a renegade band of scientists. Farmer's business was called the Prediction Company. He likened his economic work to predicting where a balloon was going to land if he sent it bouncing around a room. You couldn't say exactly, but you could come pretty close. Eerily, in light of recent events, what Mr. Farmer dabbled in was derivatives. The author explained it this way, quote, "A derivative is a sort of a bet on a bet, or a speculation squared. Third and fourth order derivatives, those betting on an option based on a bet that hinges on another gamble, up the complexity and incomprehensibility of these financial instruments," unquote. Well, exactly. All these financial institutes went belly up because they owned all these derivatives and didn't even know what was in them. In other words, to go back to Mr. Farmer's metaphor, when you release the balloon that is the economy, it might be a balloon. It might be slices of a balloon, or it might be somebody's bet on what a balloon will look like in 2012, or it may turn into a soccer ball, or suddenly explode like the Hindenburg. And anyway, it wasn't a balloon. It was an enormous Ponzi scheme. Usually in a Ponzi scheme, it's the suckers who make a bad decision and lose their shirts. In this case, the big brain Ponzis themselves believed in it and became the biggest suckers of all, and the whole thing went down like a lead balloon. The Prediction Company, by the way, signed an exclusive contract in the 90s with derivatives trading house O'Connor & Associates, which merged with Swiss Bank Corporation, which merged with Union Bank of Switzerland, which lost $12 billion in the first quarter of 2008 because of the subprime mortgage crisis, the lead balloon that sank all boats.
Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.